I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 126 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining to me today, I have a very, very special guest for this minute. I have the pleasure and honor of having as my guest Mary Owen, the daughter of Donna Reed, who plays Mary Hatch / Mary Bailey in this movie. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Okay. Yes, hello. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad I finally got someone connected to the movie to be on this season. And what a guest it is.
Thank you.
So the first question I have to ask, I mean, you know, as soon as I was introduced to you as Mary Owen, the first thought that came to my mind was, is, you know, are you somehow named after the character in this movie?
As much as I would like to say yes, I was named after my great-grandmother, Mary Mullinger. So, no, sadly, no.
Well, you could still have told people that you are if you really wanted to. You can get away either way.
Well, you know, yeah, it wouldn't be my mother, like my mother or my father, to name any of us kids after, you know, movie roles. That's right. The truth.
Okay, that's fair. That's definitely fair. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time to join me on for this minute, because I chose a minute for you where your mother is prominently shown throughout this entire minute. I mean, this is a very heavy Mary Bailey minute.
Yeah.
So
it is. Yeah, it is indeed.
Mm-hmm. Minute 126 begins with Mary leading George down the stairs and ends with Billy and Ma Bailey giving each other a hug. We ended things yesterday with basically, you know, George finally getting home, being so happy to see his kids, but he's looking for the love of his life. He's looking for his wife. He doesn't know where she is. And at the end of yesterday's minute, she comes in the door and she runs up the stairs to him, basically. She's very happy. He's very happy. And this minute begins with her basically pulling him down the stairs to the living room, where to remind everyone, that's where the four gentlemen are waiting there. You know, we have the sheriff, the bank examiner, the reporter, and the cameraman are all down there. And George is there with his, you know, he's got the kids all around him. You know, he's got Zuzu piggybacking on him and stuff like that. did you ever have the opportunity of meeting any of the actors that played the children?
I've met three of them. Carol Coombs, who played Janie, she's incredible. Zuzu, Carolyn Grimes, who I see every year at the It's a Wonderful Life Festival. She's just the most wonderful person ever. And Jimmy Hawkins, who plays Tommy, of course, played, I don't know if you're familiar with my mother's television show, but he was Shelley Fabre's boyfriend and was on the show for many, many years, and just is a great guy and speaks so highly of my mother and, you know, remembers his time on the show. Not so much, he was called Rip Van Winkle on the set, because when they would take breaks in between shots or shooting, he would just fall asleep easily and then just wake back up and be ready to, you know, do a scene.
Oh, wow.
As Tommy Bailey.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is pretty young here. He, what was he? He was probably like 5 or 6 at the time, if that.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess that makes sense. I have a feeling that the child labor laws in movies were slightly different back in the 40s than they are today. So he might have been working long hours or just sleeping long hours waiting for him to have to get into the shot or whatever it was.
Well, that could be.
Yeah, who knows? So as Mary is pulling George down the stairs, she goes, "Come on, George, come on downstairs, quick." They're on their way. And George says, "Oh, all right." She goes, "Come on." And he just starts to laugh a little bit, trying to he's just happy. And I mean, this is obviously the point of the movie where he's just so happy to see his family after everything that he's gone through.
Yeah.
He's willing to play along.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's come back from an alternate reality, and he's so glad to see her. And then, it's just an odd moment when they're all kind of waiting around because they don't know what they're waiting for.
That's right. Yeah. So
But
he just takes the opportunity to kiss her at the time, to give her a hug and kiss her, and why else? We're standing next to the Christmas tree, so you might as well, might as well, bide your time at the time, I guess you can say. And they're all standing there, and then Mary says, "Come in here now. Now you stand over here by the tree, right there, and don't move, don't move." And then we get a lot of shout-outs from the kids. Pete says, "What's happening? Who's gonna come?" And then we hear, "Oh, I hear them coming now. George, it's a miracle. It's a miracle." And then Janie says, "What's happening?" And then Tommy goes, "What's happening?" And then Pete says, "Who's gonna come, Daddy?" And Zuzu says, "Who? Daddy?" And then Mary runs over to the door, and she opens the door, and then we hear her say, "Come in, Uncle Billy, everybody, in here." At this point we see Uncle Billy show up, and he's carrying this weaved basket, which we can't really tell at the beginning what he's carrying in the basket. One of the things that is really great is right before Mary walks over to the door, she takes her arm and completely clears the table of whatever it is.
Well, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that, because I think Capra is so brilliant the way he mirrors, because when George first comes home, Jimmy Stewart first comes home, and he realizes that he's missing the 8,000, and Potter's not going to lend it to him. And eventually he does the same thing on his table with all his like architectural
Right.
renderings and papers and things like that. So I love that she mirrors that and does the same
Right. The
thing.
model of the bridge that he also breaks. Yeah, I've talked about it numerous times, the fact that Capra is a very visual director, especially in this movie. You can see it. There's a lot of things that if you're not paying attention to what's going on, you're going to miss things, because it's not all just in the dialogue. There are actions that the characters do, or just things that are happening in the background, which again, I mean, I've already gone through 125 episodes of this talking about all the various little things that we notice. But I mean, a prime example is back when George is working in the pharmacy, we see the telegram. It's not mentioned to us at all or whatever. We have to read it for ourselves. And then, George figures out everything that's going on with Mr. Gower. And then when he looks over to Mr. Gower, we see Mr. Gower looking at a picture, which obviously is presumably his son, who has died of as we said, COVID 1.0, because it was the Spanish flu. So this is another example, where if you're not paying attention, you won't see that Mary is clearing off the table with her arm in a very, I guess you can even say, aggressive way. She's not politely moving stuff. She's sweeping it all to the floor, like, "I don't really care about any of this stuff right now, because as we'll find out in a few seconds, we need this room for something more important." But
Exactly.
I like the contrast that you brought up between that and with what George did when he was upset, because I didn't even think of that connection. That's really good. Wow.
Yep, cool. Yeah, no, there's a lot of little details like that. Like even, yeah.
You had another example you wanted to give?
Well, I mean, just even that incredible Oh yeah, well, just the amazing telephone kissing scene, which of course when it was scheduled to be shot, Jimmy Stewart wasn't ready. You know, there was a lot of tension on the set because Jimmy Stewart and Frank Capra had been working on the war effort and been away from Hollywood for so many years. You know, Jimmy Stewart was a highly decorated bomber pilot and had been away for 4 or 5 years. Same with Capra. He was making the Why We Fight series. So when they came together to make this movie, there was quite a bit of insecurity, and Hollywood was different, and Capra didn't have kind of his usual buddies that he talked things over with, and felt a little lonely. So when it was time to do that particular, you know, incredible scene, such a powerful scene, Jimmy Stewart wasn't ready, so they put it off and put it off. And finally, when he was ready, you know, he asked my mother if they wanted to rehearse it. She wanted to rehearse it with him. And she said, no, let's just, so they got that scene on the first take.
Wow.
There was some dialogue missing, but Capra, you know, was also instinctual. And he just said, you know, we're going to keep that one. And, but then, so that scene's so powerful. And then later, you know, there's the other telephone scene where the teacher is called, mm-hmm. and then the teacher's husband gets on the call, and mom's trying to, you know, it's like completely opposite from that call. He does that a lot throughout the whole movie.
Oh, wow. Did you ever get the opportunity to meet Frank Capra?
I did not. Oh, okay. You know, I was, no.
Right. No, I mean, he lived into the 80s, I believe. So that's why I thought, you know, not obviously not when the movie was being filmed. That I'm aware of. You know, I meant later on. Yes. So basically, at this point, you know, we see Uncle Billy come in, and he's, you know, he's got that basket. He's carrying the big basket, and you know, he comes over to the table and then just starts pouring the contents out. And he goes, George, here's everything right here. And you see all these bills and coins start falling onto the table. There's at this point no way of counting how much it is. You know, they're probably, you know, ones and fives. But that's part of the idea here. You know, it doesn't need to be that someone's going to give them, you know, hundreds. And trying to explain, you know, try to fix this problem. It's great how the solution to this is basically nickels and dimes. You know, it's the idea that you know, everyone pulling together to be able to help George out in this situation, and not just one person saving the day. You know, which is great. And yeah. And then Billy continues talking, and he goes, "Isn't it wonderful? So many friends. Mary did it. George, Mary did it. She told some people you were in trouble, and they scattered all over town collecting money. They didn't ask any questions. They just said, George is in trouble, then count me in." So I find it really funny that Uncle Billy actually says that, because he says that George is in trouble. So Uncle Billy's not in trouble at all. He's the one who lost the money. George is covering for him. But yeah.
I know. I thought that was... that part's kind of redemptive for Billy,
yes.
Because I mean, it's nice that nobody asked any questions, because if they knew what was really going on, they might not, you know, because it is Billy. But the thing that's so funny that I just thought about is that nobody in town, except, and even Uncle Billy, doesn't know what happened to that $8,000.
Yeah, the people in Bedford Falls never find out. The only two people that know the truth, besides us, for obviously, you know, the only people within Bedford Falls that know are obviously Potter and his man. You know, that's it. You know, the goon, yeah. that's always with him.
Right. And then I was thinking too, like, Potter would be the only person in Bedford Falls who found $8,000 would keep it.
Yeah, well, of course. that's the point. You know, I've mentioned this numerous times that what's really interesting about that, the fact that Potter, that no one ever finds out that Potter has the money, is that at the time that this movie came out, you know, it was during the time of the code, and in the code, you couldn't have a criminal get away with a criminal act. There had to be some sort of repercussions. And in this movie, there's no repercussions to Potter. Wow. The only repercussion you can think of is that he doesn't have any more friends, but he didn't have friends before anyway, so it's not really something that's going to affect him through the rest of his life, you know. Did
Well,
you
in
ever
his
see,
conscience, who knows?
yeah, did you ever see the Saturday Night Live you know, they had a skit in the 80s where they said they unearthed the final scene of the movie where everyone finds out it's Potter and they go and they basically beat him up.
Yeah, that's good. There's also a funny, well, some people don't think it's funny, but Jimmy Fallon did a send up a few years ago too. I think it's still on YouTube, and it's called The Commies of Bedford Falls. So it takes kind of a different twist. It is very funny though, but it's like a Fox take on Fox News, and that, Potter's the hero, and yeah.
Interesting. All right. I'll have to check that out. I've never seen that. Sounds
Well, I
funny.
mean the movie was, I mean, Capra did get in trouble. It's hard to believe because, the movie was critical of bankers.
Yes.
I mean, of Potter. So it's just hard to believe that we lived in a time that the movie could have been perceived that way.
Right. I again they thought that this was a communist movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know why they would think that. I mean, when you watch the movie, you see that there is a message here, and the message is not a communist collective message. It's a message about helping
No.
others. So.
Well, exactly. I mean, when I first saw the movie when I was in my in college in my early 20s, and I was lucky enough to see it on the big screen, and that last scene really hit me as being part of kind of the gestalt of the 60s of like communities and people coming together to help one another. I didn't see it as being for propaganda of any kind or in any which way. It was just so human based.
I got to interject. You only saw this movie for the first time when you were in college. In your household, it wasn't something that was this ever discussed, or when it was on TV or something. Nothing.
Well, I mean, I'm, old. So,
I didn't say
when I,
video.
yeah.
I said TV.
Yeah, no, because it didn't start showing on television. I mean, I think in those days, okay, there was no cable. There really weren't any VCRs. So the only way to see an old movie would either be on television or in a movie theater. And no, I mean, I don't think it started being on television until the late 70s, and I think that's when I saw it on in the movie theater. So yeah.
I mean, I know that it was shown on TV in the 50s and 60s, not the same way that that things happened afterwards, but because I think the rights only lapsed in the early 70s, and I think that's when it really started becoming popular to show, every year around Christmas time, because it was free. That was
Well,
so.
yeah, I don't, yeah, I don't. I mean, gosh, my parents were so busy. It just seemed like the household was very busy in the 60s when my mom was doing the show, and I don't remember us watching too much television. So anyway, yes, I wasn't
Except for the
until
Donna Reed show.
in my, yeah, that is one thing we watched as a family together. But it was strange because growing up with a mother and father in the business, I just thought that was her job. Like I grew up in Beverly Hills. I didn't have any particular perspective on the business, right? That's just who she was, and that's what she did. And so when I saw the movie, I was like, wow. I mean, I got it that she was a really talented actress and that she had this whole other life before the show. And it
Well,
was
you probably had an
very
Oscar on the mantle
revealing.
also, didn't
It did, but I didn't. I hadn't seen From Here to Eternity, so I didn't. I was born after her film career was over, so that, and she tried to be a mom to us kids, so she didn't really talk shop too much, but she did have the show. It was her and my father's show. It was their idea. It was their production. So that was going on. So yeah, I didn't. Anyway, it's just kind of a strange way to grow up. I don't quite know how to explain it, but I did love seeing the movie because I got to understand her better.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's actually very cool. Yeah. You know, that one day you get to just, you know, you think of your, you know, we all think of our parents in a certain way. And then one day you see something and it just changes your perspective a little bit on things, you know. Well,
yeah, totally.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, then everyone else, more people start just coming into this living room, you know, the nonstop people just showing up, and you know, most of them are not recognizable, but there are a few at this point that you know, we can recognize who they are. I mean, Ernie shows up, along with Uncle Billy. We also see Ma Bailey show up, which is very interesting because it was just mentioned that she was in Washington at some point. So I guess she's already came back. We also see Mary's mother. So we see Mrs. Hatch.
Right.
And then we see the trio of men who, you know, were complaining when there was the bank run. So we have, you know, Tom, Ed, and Charlie are the three guys who show up. And you know, one of them says, "What is this? Another run on the bank?"
Yeah.
Finally, he's got a sense of humor. He was a little too dramatic during the bank run where he wanted to get his entire fortune out of the building alone. But at this point, you know,
that's right.
He's willing to chip in a few bucks for, you know, to help out George. And then, you know, someone else says, "Here you are, George, Merry Christmas." And then Ernie says, "Don't crowd, don't push. There we are. The line forms to the right." And then someone else comes, "More coming, George. Merry Christmas and God bless you." So it's really great how, you know, this is just the beginning. I mean, in the next few days, we'll talk even more about the more people who are going to show up. But you know, we get this initial crowd of people that are all, you know, on Christmas Eve, willing to leave whatever it is they're doing in order to come and help George. You know, and one of the things that's great about this is, you know, everyone's come in from the cold on the outside where, you know, we had seen that there's snow and everything like that. Did you happen to notice how poorly, I mean, we've talked about the snow issues in this movie. How it pretty much was like, I think it was soapy cornflakes or something like that. I don't even remember the whole thing. But if you look how it's sitting on Uncle Billy's hat and on the shoulders of his jacket, and then you know you have I think it's Tom that's right behind him also. It does not look anything like snow. It really looks like soap suds that are just sitting on them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much emotion going on. You know what I mean? Like, that's got to be one of the best near and close to endings in film history. I mean, my God, all the feelings, especially, you know, when my mother's, you know, bringing him down the stairs and he's finally, you know, back with his family and she's, I mean, there's just so much feeling like nobody else knows what he just went through. And then as the camera's from his point of view and he looks at, you know, Violet and all these different people, I know this is not in our minute.
That's okay.
But it's just so emotional. I mean, he's seeing these people like back where they are instead of how he just saw them.
Right.
You know, that scene with Violet is so violent where they're taking her away. Yeah. And so that just the mixed feelings, I mean, there's just the joy of the, you know, community coming together, which is so great. And then, you know, a little bit later, there's the whole issue of Sam Wainwright, which is, you know, kind of a painful issue because he's the one who's giving the money that's going to help George out. But he sort of had the life that George might have wanted.
Correct.
I mean, not flashy, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that, you know, we've talked a lot about that, about the fact that, you know, Sam was always trying to get George in, you know, on the ground floor to all of his businesses. And George wanted to do it on his own. You know, he didn't want to join Sam. He wanted it to be George Bailey making these millions.
Yeah.
I'll talk about this later in the week when we actually get to that scene. But I've actually always had a problem with the fact that we have Sam Wainwright in the end bail him out. because it sort of negates the fact that everyone else gave their money. Because now you just have someone who's what I think, if I remember correctly, he's willing to afford him up to $25,000, which, yeah, but
Well,
yeah.
yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, sometimes I think that Sam Wainwright's character was just kind of there for that part, for the ending scene, because I don't think those five and $1 bills in the basket are going to equal $8,000. So, you know.
Probably
But
not, but
anyway,
again,
yeah.
it's the thought at this point.
It is.
I mean,
It
come on,
is.
even if you look at when Uncle Billy was in the bank, there's no way that the wad of cash that he was holding was $8,000 anyway, because
Yeah,
we can
that's
see that
true.
there are that some of them are $5 bills. So,
Yeah.
but I mean, we've raised a lot of questions about that, about like why are they depositing $8,000? Like, because $8,000, I always forget how much it's worth today, but we're talking a few hundred thousand dollars. And like, why were they holding
Yeah.
on to it?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, good point. But yeah, I think, you know, the thing that I love about this scene in terms of my mother is that, you know, for me, Mary Hatch Bailey is really kind of the other hero in the film. She is rock solid. She never wavers from what she wants. And she's always kind of saving George. You know, there are other scenes. And so this is just makes perfect sense. You know, she's kind of guiding him down the stairs and, you know, leading him to his, you know, next phase of being saved or whatever. And she, you know, I think she invokes in the beginning too. She's, you know, part of the prayer circle that's, you know, invoking the people from above to, you know, get an angel to save him. And she's been solid the whole time. She's never, her target has always been George. And, you know, being in Bedford Falls, she's never wavered. She's never wanted something different. And I think that that's been, you know, that's what I love about her character. And then that she, you know, makes it all happen at the
Yeah,
end.
you know what? I'll even go further. I mean, I've mentioned this briefly a few times over the course of all these episodes, but a lot of people have criticism in general about movies in the 30s and 40s where most of the female characters are there just for show. This is one of the few movies where it's the exact opposite. I mean, Mary Hatch Bailey is one of the best female characters in movie history around this time, because she's the one who's constantly there pushing George to be greater. George has his own
Yeah.
thoughts of how he wants to be great, but in the end, it's Mary who's doing it. I mean, even if you go all the way back to when they were kids, Mary knew
Yeah.
what she wanted, and she's the one who gets her wishes throughout the entire
Yeah.
the, this
Yeah.
entire life, of what she
Yeah.
has. George doesn't get the wishes that he thinks he wants.
Right. Right.
He has, delusions that he's going to travel the world and do things, and whenever there's an opportunity to do so, his conscience tells him, I'm needed here, so I'm going to stay here, even though I don't want to be here. And Mary
Yeah.
is constantly by his side for everything. So, I mean,
Yeah.
she's a great character in in this movie. And exactly like you said, she's the one who's facilitating everything. Even if you go back into when there was a bank run, she's the one who suggested giving out their money.
Yeah, I love that scene. That's
It wasn't
fantastic. I know.
George who
I
says it.
know.
She's like, I got
Yeah.
$2,000.
Right. And, you know, I mean, and just to going along with what you're saying too, is like in many ways they're equals because they share the same values. I mean, there's no way she would have ever married Sam Wainwright if there had been no George. If there had been no
Well, she was an
George,
old maid at the age of 33 as a librarian, so of course she wouldn't have.
Well, no, I mean, I think that there's been a problem of, you know, her being a librarian, but I read a really interesting essay a few years ago, and the truth is that there was nobody else in Bedford Falls that would have been appropriate for her. It was really, you know, and vice versa for
Okay,
George.
I
So.
completely agree with that. I mean, I even only when I've seen this movie many times, probably not as many times as you, but I've seen this movie probably a
Yeah.
dozen times, if not more. But I never noticed until I was doing it now, minute by minute, and watching each thing in detail, that when Sam is on the phone talking to George and Mary, you know, trying to convince them to go, you know, to invest in his company, and the two of them are more interested in investing within one another, but Sam is I don't know what the right word is, playing around with some other woman who's behind him. So I don't know why Mrs. Hatch thinks that Sam is interested in Mary.
Yeah, exactly. And also, even, you know, one of my favorite scenes too is the blessing of the McHenry house. Yes. And of course, just before that happens, Sam is there, you know, going hee-haw or whatever. And my mother says, "Oh, who cares?" Which is totally how my mother would have been in real life. You know,
like, I wonder if she ad-libbed it.
She might have. She just, you know, he would have held no interest to her whatsoever.
That's true. It makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess they needed it there to try and you know, I mean, that the scene when they're on the phone, I think Sam Wainwright is being used there to try to make George jealous. That's all it is.
Yes.
And it's not because Mary's interested in Sam. She's more interested in getting George jealous so that he'll actually open his eyes and see what's in front of him.
Well, yeah, right. Cause he's just kind of wandering over there and he's kind of crabby. Cause you know, his brother's getting married to Virginia Patton and all this kind of stuff. And so it's just what he needed to, you know, figure it out.
Yeah. I don't think George was upset about the fact that Harry was getting married. I think he was upset about the fact that he was getting stuck in Bedford Falls again.
Right.
It wasn't jealousy of Harry getting married. It was, you know.
Right. That's what I meant.
No, I know. I was just, you know, just pointing that out, clarifying it. Yeah.
But there's also, I don't know if you know this, but in that scene where they're blessing the McHenry house and then
the Martini house.
Sorry.
Yeah, you said the McHenry house, and I was trying to think of who the McHenrys are. But I said, okay,
yeah,
maybe
sorry.
Maybe I missed
the
Martini.
Martinis. I'm so sorry.
No need to apologize. Yeah.
There's a scene where they're walking away together. You know, it's kind of like those new housing and, you know, Sam and his person go off in their fancy car and then
driving mother, to Florida, which will take them like 24 hours to drive at that time.
Yeah, right. Those cars probably don't go more than like 45.
And they didn't have interstates the same way they do today.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't even thought of that. Anyway, so when they kind of turn away from the camera and walk, my mother puts her hand on her stomach, and that's kind of a foreshadowing of the fact that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm.
Ah, I didn't even notice that because I was paying attention to the fact that George kicks the door of the car at that point because he's upset that his car is more of a jalopy than what Sam has. Oh wow, that's interesting. I didn't even think about that fact.
And then the other thing, going a little further back of that scene, just because, you know, as many of your listeners may or may not know, my mother grew up in rural Iowa, Western Iowa. She was the oldest of five, and grandma and grandpa had, you know, farm about 250 acres. And so I think a lot of that, just equal work between boys and girls, men and women, and just, you know, town was about 6 miles away, but I'm sure when she was a teenager, she probably saw things that happened in It's a Wonderful Life. She probably saw banks fail. She, you know, this kind of thing, the depression was coming on when she was a teenager. But I love that scene when they get in the car, you know, and she's holding a baby and the goat is there and Jimmy Stewart's looking a little nervous because, you know, it's a goat, but, you know, mom just reaches over and grabs the horn on the goat and the kids jump in and, you know, everything's just fine.
Yeah. What I like about that scene is that they fake us out. They make it seem at the beginning that it's their baby,
right?
Because I think George says something like, "You sure you got the baby?" or something like that. And, you know, and then we think it's theirs. And then we find out afterwards that it's actually the Martinis, you know. They did a nice job of doing that. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think Frank Capra, I mean, I'm not 100% certain, but I think he wanted Jean Arthur. She wasn't available. And then Ginger Rogers is Mary Bailey, who neither one was available, and so he had seen her, and they were expendable, my mom, with a great movie. John Ford and Capra were good friends, and so he went to MGM. So I guess I stopped talking about my mother, but she went to school in Iowa, and then when it was time to go to college, there were no local colleges nearby, but she had an aunt who had married a guy, and they'd moved to L.A., and so Aunt Mildred had invited my mother to move in with her and, you know, do chores and all this kind of stuff and attend Los Angeles City College, which at the time, if it wasn't free, it was, you know, extremely affordable. And, you know, she was always told that she was way too shy. She would never make it as an actress. But I think she probably might have been more interested in radio. Anyway, the last year that she was a student at LACC, they started their beauty contest, which they still do. And she won, and it got her like in the Rose Parade and all these different, you know, all this attention, including a picture in the Los Angeles Times. And once people, you know, agents and that kind of thing started contacting her to be a model, to be an actress, this kind of thing. And she put them off because she wanted to graduate in case, you know, the acting thing didn't work out. But by God, you know, by the time she was 20, she'd signed an 8-year contract with MGM.
Oh, wow.
And so she was still in that contract. Dad, who he started off as her agent, and then they married in 1945. Actually, while they were filming, they were expendable. And so when Frank Capra went to MGM to meet my mother, he knew the minute he met her that she would be perfect as Mary Bailey.
Oh, wow. And we're all the better for it.
Definitely.
Wow. The way that this minute then ends is we see Ma Bailey coming over to Billy, you know, giving him a hug. And that's pretty much that's how this minute ends. Do you recall your mother's thoughts, like, on her performance? I don't know. I mean, did she ever discuss these type of things? Or like you said, you know, work was left at work and, you know, you just discussed family stuff at home.
Yeah, she didn't really talk about it that much. And of course, you know, in the, well, we would have it on in the background sometimes, you know, in the '80s. And, it was a mixed blessing. I mean, of course she was so glad that it was popular again because the movie did not do well, as many people who love the movie know. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, critically well accepted, but it just didn't do well at the box office. And so, you know, so as I had mentioned earlier, there was this insecurity coming back from the war for a lot of people, including Jimmy Stewart. So he blamed her for the movie not doing well, which is horrible.
How does that? I mean, if it's because of coming back from the war, like, why would, you know, that sounds a little strange that he would, you know, how is she connected to that? You know?
Well, I mean, I think if you look back before the war, he and Capra had such incredible success together. And in fact, a lot of the way they advertised It's a Wonderful Life was that, you know, Capra and Stewart were together mm-hmm. again. So, but I know that she said it was the hardest she'd ever worked, that Capra was demanding. He wasn't mean or, you know, difficult. He was just demanding. And I'm sure it had to have been different than working with the MGM directors. You know, he was such a visionary, and if he got stuck somewhere and he couldn't figure out a scene or something, he'd actually close down the set until he could get it right.
So he was a perfectionist. And,
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I've heard from Carolyn Grimes, who plays Zuzu, that scene that we're talking about of them coming down the stairs was, they did like 20 takes of it.
Oh, wow. Wait, 20 takes of it because she wasn't hanging on his back properly, or just...
Who knows? I don't know. I don't know. But I, you know, I think it's one of her most, it was her most favorite work experience. And I like to think that she was inspired by Capra's, you know, individuality. I mean, he really was one of our great independent filmmakers. I mean, with Liberty Films, this is their first film. He was kind of tired of being in servitude to Columbia. That she and my dad started their own production company, you know, because after she won the Oscar and From Here to Eternity, she ended up mostly in B-Westerns. And she just had had enough. And so they made a couple of movies together, she and my dad, and then they decided to try television, 1958.
And that seems to have worked out.
Yeah, it did well. Eight seasons. Wow. And those were long seasons. My childhood can attest to it. I mean, they go from September to May. I mean, each season has like 39, 36 episodes. Wow.
That's almost double what they do nowadays for normal TV shows. Not even talking about, limited series, which have like 10, you know. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
I mean, as you said, your mother went to work every day and came home, and it wasn't that she was on location all the time. She'd go to the office, go work, and then still be home for you and your siblings. So that's important too.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. So is there anything else that you can remember connected to this movie from your mother's perspective, from your perspective?
Nowadays, we have so many conflicts, especially, you know, when we were in the United States was in Afghanistan for so long. And, you know, the war was kind of abstract, but World War II, everybody participated, including actors and actresses. And my mother was part of the pinup culture, and she saved over 350 letters written to her by World War II soldiers. I didn't find these letters until long after she had passed away, so I didn't know about them. So I kind of had to educate myself because I didn't really learn that much about World War II in school, which is so strange. But the fact that she was part of this and got together with actresses once a week to answer the letters so they weren't, you know, so everyone participated in the war effort, but I think what makes my mom cool is that she saved the letters.
You still have all those letters?
I do. I would love to publish them. So if any listeners are out there. but I just thought I would read a couple because it takes you back, and it's also just kind of a nice thing to, you know, think about when you watch the movie, because it is kind of a Depression era movie and the war does factor into it, you know, at the end. And everyone, you know, Ward Bond, all these people had participated in the war effort, including my mother. And so I just wanted to read a couple of letters.
Of course.
If that's okay. Yeah. So this one is, thank you. This one is dated May 5th, 1944, from Beachhead, Italy. Dear Miss Reed, we here on the Beachhead had the opportunity of seeing you in See Here, Private Hargrove, and we were delighted with your performance. We have what we call the Tunnel Club, and we've elected you Miss Tunnel 1944. The Tunnel Club is composed of five lonely officers of this ACAC brigade. We sleep in a tunnel under the remains of an Italian villa. Congratulations on your swell performance, and we're looking forward to seeing you again on the screen. Sincerely, your five tunneliers, Joe, Hank, Big Ugly, George, and Jim. Yeah, so I think these pinup girls, you know, were like talisman or something. They really represented the home front in a very tangible way. And there, by 1944, 45, my mother was in a couple of movies, well, especially 44, that were being shown overseas, you know, in base camps, that kind of thing. And this is what got the guys through the war, really. There was no internet. There was just letter writing, basically. Wow.
That is a great letter.
Yeah, thank you.
And I mean, you said that she responded to them, but you probably don't have copies of her responses. Yeah.
Well, so a few years ago, I mean, most of the, you know, all the guys who wrote to her are deceased, but I did speak to a couple of them back in like the early 2000s. And they said what happened was anytime they moved, they had to really discard anything that wasn't just part of their regular provisions because it might give away some kind of information if they got captured. Yeah. But I mean, if you want and then you have time, I do have one letter that I found that was written using carbon copy that my mother wrote. And I'd be happy to read it.
If
it's fantastic. Dear Private Davidson, soldier, you have given me a thrill. I suppose every actress in Hollywood receives letters from the men in service today. I know that most of mine are from the armed forces, but I'm sure no letter ever brought greater pleasure than has yours. You say that I'm the kind of girl you'd like to come home to. That's the finest compliment I've ever been paid. The forgotten persons in this war are the girls you men have left behind. I assure you they haven't forgotten you. And if, in your mind at least, I can represent our American girls on the home front, I'm flattered. In Hollywood, we seem to be so limited in what we can do. Oh, it's true that we make personal appearances, we stage Bond rallies, and we visit the Hollywood canteen. But there's so many of our boys in uniform, and we can reach so few of them. That's why a message such as yours, telling how some of us have become your pinup girls, gives me a thrill. It means we have been able to reach a few more of you. I'm afraid that I'm a poor hand at writing letters, but I do try to answer everyone from a soldier or a sailor. Some of us here at the studio have formed a club, which we get together once a week for the sole purpose of writing our answers. It makes it more sociable and also ensures our getting it done. Marsha Hunt, Lorraine Day, Ruth Hussey, and Susan Peters are some of our regular members who never miss a meeting. Well, as I said, I'm not much at letter writing myself, but I did want you to know how much I appreciated your note. It hardly seems to balance, but you keep fighting and thinking of us, and we'll keep writing and thinking of you. And if you insist, we'll even try to keep glittering, as you put it. Sincerely, wow. Donna Reed.
Wow. I mean, I'm not trying to belittle it, but I wonder if they had like form letters of how they were to respond, or whether each and every one of these letters was very personal. That's great.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I do have several letters that say that they thank you and they received a picture. So probably an autographed picture, and maybe that's it, you know, with something signed on the picture.
Okay. If she was responding to so many letters, you can't expect her to have been agile enough to write something new for each and every one of them. You know, that's understandable.
Yeah.
You know, wow. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. Did you have any other letters that you wanted to read, or those were the ones you wanted to read?
Yeah, I can read. So see here, Private Hargrove was a MGM kind of B movie with Robert Walker. And it's a cute little movie. So Marion Hargrove wrote the book. He was a journalist called See Here, Private Hargrove, and he enlisted in the Army, and he just was very cheeky and sarcastic. So he was always doing KP duty. But so it's a movie about enlistment, and my mother plays his love interest, and at one point they are talking, and she says to him, because he's talking about how he's going to be going off to war soon, and that she would really like to have a soldier to write to. And I think that just also really sparked the imagination of these guys.
Okay, that makes sense.
Well. Let's see. Gosh, I have so many. This is from Phil Erner in 1944, and he says, just somewhere, because, you know, that all the envelopes of these letters have the stamp of the censor, because they couldn't really let you know where you were located. Dear Miss Reed, I'm rather at a loss for words as I begin this letter. However, I may say that you rate number one on my Hollywood hit parade. Many of my shipmates are aware of this fact and have, in a sense, dared me to write to you. I know this is most irregular, but never let it be said that I didn't at least try. I imagine you receive copious amounts of fan mail, and I've little time to answer them. So in view of that, I shan't expect too much. I dare say I would be more than elated hearing from you, and the astonishment of my buddies would be most pleasant to behold. I remain a constant admirer. Wow. Phil.
Again, it makes sense. I mean, you have all these soldiers and sailors fighting for the world, and you know, none of they don't know what's going to happen. So if that's something that's going to help you keep going, then you know, why not? I mean, I don't know. Have you ever seen Starlink 17?
No.
Okay, so in that movie, it's a Billy Wilder film about soldiers in a POW camp during World War II, and two of them are constantly talking about Betty Grable.
Yeah.
The entire time.
Yeah.
You know, that they have a pinup of Betty Grable. Yeah. And, that's keeping their spirits up. So I can completely understand why, you know, everyone will try and find, you know, who is there, as you mentioned, the pinup girl that they want to be in contact with, you know, and hey, why not? If it helps keep the morale up.
Yeah.
And I completely understand that.
Yeah. And also these letters, they don't, you know, they're so polite. They don't really talk about what's actually going on. I mean, there's one guy writing from, you know, somewhere in the Pacific, and they sat and watched the movie in the pouring rain, and, you know, just and those guys saw a lot of scary stuff, but you know, they just, they really, and Betty Grable, you know, it's funny, 'cause I think my mother was a little younger than some of the, you know, sort of regular pinup girls. And so I think also she probably more than them represented the home front. Like, you know, yeah, I got to survive. I want to get home and I want to marry someone like Donna Reed and start a family. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yes. This has all been fascinating.
Yeah. Good. I mean, this is amazing what you're doing. And, I just want to say that, I also, during the holidays, introduce It's a Wonderful Life in theaters, mostly in New York City. And I just love that this film continues to grow, continues its popularity. My audience now has a lot of 20-year-olds in it who grew up watching it with their families and want to maintain the tradition. And I don't know. I mean, and every year it just hits me differently. I see something the movie is just so rich and so fantastic. And I just don't know of any other film that's, you know, 76 years old and just keeps speaking to so many people.
All right. Is this your favorite film of your mother's?
It depends. Sometimes it is. Okay. Sometimes it's From Here to Eternity. I mean, she made over 40 films, and a lot of them are just kind of B movies that don't get a lot of exposure, but she's quite good in all of them. So, I can't really say it's my favorite, but sometimes it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I have to be careful because I have seen it too many times. So
I don't think there is such a, I don't think that's a problem. What? You know, you get to know a movie by heart that you've seen it so many times, but just like me, I'm assuming that, you know, most people, when you watch a movie over and over, every time you'll notice something new. Yes. You'll never, you never reach the point where you say, okay, I've seen everything there is to be seen.
Well, that's true, but some movies just don't hold up after the first time, I think.
You know? Oh, for sure, but It's a Wonderful Life is not in that category.
No, it's definitely not. And I mean, even when you were mentioning earlier about, you know, the letter to Mr. Gower about his son dying of influenza or whatever. Well, you know, 10 years ago, that wouldn't have mattered. But now that we've been through COVID-19, it's like, yeah, that was a pandemic back then.
That's right. That's very true. Yeah. The telegram raised a lot of questions as to where he was. You know, it was from some university. So is he teaching at the university? Is he a student there? Huh. You know, there's a lot of questions that can be brought up about the wording of the telegram. But if you ever get a chance, you should listen to the episodes of the show. Maybe it'll give you more insight about things that you never thought about also with this movie.
And no doubt. So, I will. Thank you. Yeah.
Or maybe you'll have comments about things that we got wrong. It happens also. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I for me, it's being able to discuss the movie. And if I want to discuss something that I got wrong, that's fine too.
Yeah.
You know, my one of the theories that I've brought up many times of this show, and how did Mr. Potter get to the second floor of the building alone?
Yeah. Oh my God, that's funny. Yeah.
There's no elevator, and my running theory. That's right. So my running theory is that he's not really wheelchair bound, and that he's just faking it to get sympathy. Huh. And that when he gets to the bottom of the stairs, he runs up the stairs and the goon takes the chair.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Lionel Barrymore was in a wheelchair, right?
Yes. That's the reason why the character was in a wheelchair. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't talking about Lionel Barrymore. I was talking about the character.
I know. That is funny, though.
I'm still amazed that he was not nominated he wasn't even nominated for an Oscar for his work here.
Yeah.
Because he's clearly as great as all the other actors are in this movie, Leno Barrymore is just amazing here.
Yeah, I agree.
And whatever, I don't know if he would have been able to beat Harold Russell that year. That's a separate issue, but still.
Yeah, competing with the best years of our lives is tough.
Yes, it really is.
Very tough. There's a story, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but Lionel Barrymore had worked with my mother previously to It's a Wonderful Life and could not believe that this gorgeous, beautiful woman had grown up like, you know, on a farm. And so he put a $25 bond down that she could not milk a cow.
Really?
So they found a cow and, LA at the time was still pretty rural. And she said that it was the easiest money she ever made in her life. but I don't know if it's true. I mean, when they were,
it is mentioned on IMDb. So
yeah.
That doesn't mean it's true, but I'm saying it says both Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed came from small towns. Stewart from Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Reed from Denison, Iowa. She demonstrated her rural roots by winning an impromptu bet with Lionel Barrymore when he challenged her to milk a cow on set.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. But so it sounds like, yeah, he must have been fun to work with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the mean old Mr. Potter.
Yeah. So, so this was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I love doing it because, you know, as I'm a big movie fan and, you know, why not break down a movie like this? Because you see so much that you don't normally see when you watch a movie.
Well, it's true. And you kind of, in taking it out of context a little bit, it really, you know, gives you an opportunity to come at it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. That is so cool.
For sure. Yes. A place where people can go to get information about Donna Reed. I think you said it was the Donna Reed Foundation.
Yes. So my mother left her Oscar and everything she saved from her film career and the TV show to her hometown in Denison, Iowa. And we've established a foundation. We bought a beautiful old vintage theater and the museum's in there. And then the temperature controlled archive is down in the basement. And then we support 6 other businesses in the space. So you can find us at donnareed.org. You can find me there somehow, probably just asking about info. And also we would love membership, and you know, people want to donate, that'd be great too. We need a new roof. The building's from 1914, but yeah. So my mom made these scrapbooks. I didn't know anything about them until recently. They're like Pinterest. She was doing her own biography in these scrapbooks of her film career. And it's just incredible, the things from It's a Wonderful Life and the congratulations telegrams from all of her peers, including Frank Capra when she won the Oscar, and, you know, all this newspaper clippings from all the movies. And it's just incredible. And I haven't even begun to go through all of it, but I hope to get it digitized. I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent, but yes, you can find me at Don.
That's what this is for. We always go off on tangents. That's okay.
Yeah.
You're not going off on a tangent because you're talking about Donna Reed and you're talking about It's a Wonderful Life. So how is that a tangent? Okay. And even if you weren't, it's connected.
Well,
so
and yeah, and
go with the flow.
Thank you. And I just found her spelling bee medal that she won in 1929. So she was 8 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And just a lot of cool stuff. And so that's.
So she knew how to spell.
She, yeah. This, you know what else?
So, in other words, when Petey asks her how you spell frankincense and hallelujah, she really knew those things off right off the bat.
I know. I'd love to know what the word was that she won, but I don't. So, yes. So, yeah, check us out at donnareed.org. And, yeah, and I, you know, I like to talk about her film career and the TV show. That's really, I know more about that because that's my childhood. And, you know, I was on the set all the time. And well, this has been really fun.
Yeah, it really has. And thank you very much for taking the time to discuss your mother's work on this film. I mean, like we said, she is definitely one of the main tentpoles of this movie. And I learned so many insightful things about your mother. So thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Ah, you're welcome. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and good luck.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. I will be back tomorrow with another guest, but until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.